Welcome back to the program. Certainly with Earth Day just around the corner, it reminds us that few of the issues that we face today are as pressing as our changing environment and our sources and uses of energy. What many of us don't realize is that behind all of our current efforts to reduce our impact on the planet, there is a history over 150 years of invention and innovation with respect to being green and green technology. We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior editor and lead technology reporter for TheAtlantic.com. He's a visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley, and a former staff writer for Wired.com. It is my pleasure to welcome him here today to talk about powering the dream, the history and promise of green technology. Alexis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good to have you here. This notion that, you know, go back 150 years and people were really thinking about these issues is something that I think that is lost on so many people today.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's since we've been burning fossil fuels, people realize that they generated soot and smoke and other sorts of things that people didn't like. And in fact, you know, if you go back to, say, you know, 1900, there was this whole problem called the smoke nuisance in the large cities of America, where people just, you know, it was ruining their clothes, it was making people sick, and there was an entire movement, actually, to get rid of coal power out of the cities of America.
And it's interesting when you look at, and you talk about the electric cabs that once traveled New York, and certainly the red car, the electric red cars in Los Angeles, there was a whole set of options that once existed in some of these cities.
That's right. I think, you know, particularly if you look at transportation, you can see some fascinating things. You know, in New York around 1900, and actually across the country, about a third of the cars on the road were gasoline-powered. A third were powered by electricity, and a third were powered by steam. So we had all of these different options for what the final technical form of the car was going to look like. And in fact, we just happened to go down the internal combustion engine powered path. And what's interesting is that people at the time, you know, we tend to, I think, underestimate how smart people were in the past. I mean, they knew that there would be these problems, right? And they would say, oh, you know, there's going to be all this pollution. There's, you know, it's going to be loud. It's going to be noisy. And in fact, offered the electric vehicle as an alternative. I mean, the first organized car company in America was, in fact, an electric car company that ran cabs all around New York.
What happened? This seems that it was more than just an accident. Certainly, if we take Los Angeles and the red cars as an example, it really was the influence of the auto industry and the fossil fuel industry that really drove them out of business.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly in Los Angeles, the story is really fascinating. For those who don't know it, I mean, basically, you know, if you think of like an old Chuck Berry song where they run through all the big cities of America, all of those places had trolley lines. Los Angeles had some of the most famous, actually, just because they're completely gone, and they would have gotten you just about anywhere you would have wanted to go in Los Angeles. You know, there are obviously a lot of pressures that would cause, you know, trolley lines to be ripped out of the ground and replaced with highways. But I think, you know, obviously the influence of GM, fossil fuel industry, was a big one. And the other big one, though, that I think one that's a little bit underestimated, is the people who controlled the trolley lines tended to be the richest people in town. And so there was a real kind of class component, too. And I think a lot of people perceived the trolley lines just being a way that, you know, the elites of a city would enrich itself by, you know, building a subdevelopment and then putting a trolley line out there as opposed to building the lines where people really needed them.
Even in other areas of renewable energy, as you write about, something like solar was on the boards as early as the 70s and yet never really got traction.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it depends on what we mean if something got traction. I think actually solar has gotten traction several times in the 20th century and just has the industry has gone away. I mean, one of the stories I tell is of the solar hot water heating industry in the early part of the 20th century where, you know, if you'd gone to Pasadena, California and looked on the roofs, there would have been solar panels in 1905 heating water kind of on the same principle. That you would use, you know, or not that you would use, but that would happen to your car if you sort of left it in a mall parking lot. It can get pretty hot in there. And I think it's interesting, you know, there is a way that fossil fuels tend to interact with the way that the market system works in this country, or what we think of as the free markets, in the sense that, you know, all of the downsides of fossil fuels get charged to society, while all of the upsides get charged to the companies that sell those fuels. And I think that's solar, because it internalizes more of its costs, like isn't actually as cheap a lot of the time, even though there's been, you know, substantial work to bring down the power of photovoltaics, which convert the sun's light into electricity, and also solar thermal plants, like the ones they're putting in out in the Mojave and that have existed there since the 1980s.
You also write about this experiment with geothermal energy that goes back to really the end of the 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, geothermal energy is actually one of the easier things you can imagine to tap, just because you know, we know that if you go down, particularly in some areas of the country, into the ground, it's hot there. And it was there have been plants operating in Northern California actually for a long time, and it's pretty easy because, you know, when you look at a geyser, what you're seeing there is essentially you're seeing energy, heat come out of the ground, right? And so if you can imagine that heat is underground, and then you're able to tap into it via, you know, just standard mechanical means, then you can generate steam, and steam is what runs power plants.
Why is it, though, even when we look within the context of more recent history, look at the oil shocks of the late 70s, we see that they were still lost opportunities in so many of these areas of renewable and sustainable energy?
Yeah, you know, we haven't put consistent effort behind ensuring these things happen. You know, I mean, I think people often talk about kind of the shock and trance of American energy thinking, and it's true. I mean, when gas prices go up, people go crazy and want things solved like yesterday. And when gas prices go down, they kind of forget about it. And if you were to try and design like a real policy, what you would do is almost the exact opposite. You would either maintain like sort of constant funding, or you would have government funding be sort of countercyclical. So when the price of oil was high, the government wouldn't do as much. When the price of oil was low, it'd be pouring it on. And the reason is that when energy prices of any sort go up, lots of private enterprise gets involved. And when energy prices in alternative energy, and when energy prices go down, it's harder for those companies to stay alive. And so some European countries have been much smarter about keeping the people who are working in alternative energy in the industry through what we know are going to be cycles of price fluctuations for fossil fuels.
But, of course, there have also been decisions made with respect to public policy and where certain subsidies go that have had an influence on all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think we like in this country to talk about free markets so much, and the problem with energy is that there really is no such thing, and nor has there ever been one, and nor has really any country ever had a free market for energy. And it's too important to military, it's too important to government, it's too important to everyone, and so we just have never approached anything close to a free market. I mean, if you go back to the way the utilities came into being, right? I mean, they were regulated monopolies from basically the get-go. If you look at the oil industry, I mean, they've been given all the exploration that oil companies used to do, where they could write it off on their taxes. And you know, it's an interesting and kind of fascinating realm, the sort of like the history of energy incentives in America. And it's the thing is, like, I don't even know that was necessarily a bad thing to incentivize energy companies to go find more oil. Mm-hmm. But I think they were trying to solve a different problem than the one we're trying to solve now.
It's often been in the context of solving problems, as you say. One of the things that seems to have been missing, and there are a few individuals that you point to along the way, is anyone that came along and really created a powerful narrative with respect to why green energy was important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think, you know, part of that is a lot of the push has come out of the more traditional environmental movement. That's sort of like been the public face of green energy. And it's interesting because, you know, both in my research for the book and also my just reporting at my job here at The Atlantic or before at Wired, you know, you run into all kinds of characters who are involved with green technology. And I think a lot of them are not traditional environmentalists. In fact, they are more interested in sort of technology, like more traditional technologists, people who are interested in like making new things work. And I think that, like, you know, gra- connecting that way of thinking or combining that way of thinking with, you know, the idea that we need to protect the environment is actually really potent, right? Because it's really effective. People love new technologies and new stuff, and they love seeing new things work in the world. And I think that is ultimately the promise of green technology, that it becomes a really potent way for the environmental movement to answer these sort of long-time objections that Americans have had about it, in that, you know, they have oftentimes wanted to stop power plants from going in, and now they can actually provide an alternative. Well, how about this other type of power plant or this other way of using and making energy?
Why wasn't there more of a convergence early on between the green movement and Silicon Valley in its earliest days, or even more specifically, you know, places like, you know, Xerox Park and MIT and Caltech? Why didn't that convergence happen?
Well, you know, it kind of did. From the earliest days, a lot of the solar home research was going on at MIT. I think if you look at someone like a Stuart Brand, who was involved with the Whole Earth Catalog and sort of the counterculture, and then eventually became involved with a lot of cyberculture stuff, there's a lot of crossover between the people who were interested in alternative energy in the 1970s and people who got interested in computing and the internet in the next two decades. What's interesting, though, is that it really wasn't until the 2000s before the two sort of interests recombined. It was almost like the interesting thing was alternative energy, and then the interesting thing was computers, and then it took 20 years for people to go, oh, maybe we should combine these two ways of thinking into this, you know, the new kind of green technology venture capital model, which we saw really emerge in the 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Who have been some of the leaders and some of the leading voices, and you talk about a few, in this movement in trying to bring technology and sustainability into, you know, what we're seeing in the 21st century?
Yeah, I mean, I think the John Doerr, who was kind of legendary venture capitalist, you know, he's really been at the forefront of trying to make climate concerns and alternative energy sort of a pressing issue for the Silicon Valley crowd, and I think that he has done actually a great job of. And I mean, it's funny because, you know, in any story you're going to leave out some pieces, right? I think he's done a great job of promoting green technology as a sort of carrier of the banner of progress. The interesting thing is that 1970s environmentalists, I think, would sort of be like, wait a second, we already sort of talked about the idea of progress and sort of made it more complex and, you know, came up with ways of thinking about progress as not just meaning economic growth. And in fact, John Doerr is like old school in the sense that he equates progress with just sort of like economic growth, jobs, like building the strength of America. I mean, it's a very almost like pre-70s, pre-60s even way of thinking about progress.
Right.
But I actually think it's pretty effective rhetorically, and I think he actually believes it too.
Right. And you can even go back to, you talk about a guy who was FDR's science advisor, and that's an interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, again, just to counter the idea that all alternative energy has been like hippies in the 1970s, I mean, I think the 70s are way more interesting than people give them credit for intellectually in energy. But also if you go back even farther to like the 1940s, the first megawatt scale wind turbine was built in Rutland, Vermont, with the support of a lot of people who were actually involved in the U.S. World War II military effort, including a guy named Vannevar Bush, who is famous for a lot of different things, one of which is, you know, supporting this wind power project, and maybe more significantly for a lot of people, was sort of in on the beginnings of the Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm. When we look forward from where we are now, where do you think that the most history is useful in providing advances where we are now?
Well, I think, you know, obviously, I mean, policy is sort of boring to everyone, I think, but I mean, there's obviously some interesting policy lessons about how California structured its incentives in the 1980s. I mean, a really obvious example is back then, the incentives were doled out on the basis of sort of how many wind machines or how many solar plants you were able to get into the ground, as opposed to the actual production from those places. And what that means, kind of the obvious outcome of that kind of scenario, is that people put the cheapest possible machines in the ground without actually thinking too much about how well they're going to work. So, you know, that's something we've learned. And I think maybe as significantly on the technological side, we found that material science has really been the key for a lot of energy innovation, not just alternative energy, but traditional fossil fuels too. Like basically the falling price of electricity from 1900 to 1965, which is one of the greatest technological triumphs of all time, has a lot to do with being able to come up with better steel, which made better boilers. And those boilers were able to be bigger and more efficient, and the price comes down. And, you know, the, sort of the amount of power you get out per unit of fossil fuel that you burn increases. And so I think looking forward, you could look to material science again, but in this case, looking at photovoltaics, again, the materials that convert the sun's light directly into electricity, it's kind of a miraculous operation, and they're getting a lot better as a result of all this innovation around material science, or what we used to would have called, you know, something like chemistry or metallurgy.
Right. The area that is also emerging in this, and certainly there are limits on it at the moment, but beyond the material sciences is the degree to which biology is now entering into the energy equation.
Mm-hmm. I think biology is like actually a bit of the X factor. You know, there's all of this innovation going on, not just with traditional biotechnology companies that we've seen in the Bay Area, but you know, guys like Craig Venter, who are trying to build custom-designed organisms that will do things like produce oil. I mean, you know, so far, you know, it hasn't worked out. But the cost of both decoding genomes and also synthesizing new genes and new genomes for organisms is really coming down in this crazy way. And I think we're just beginning to understand what that's going to mean for the energy future, to have essentially every, you know, little oil-producing factory, which is what these organisms are, also contain, you know, the ability to replicate itself. Like, we don't really know what that's going to do to our energy picture, you know, way out in the future when we know a lot more about how genes and genetics work.
One of the other aspects that's particularly interesting is that now that this whole discussion has gone as global as it has, it takes out of the equation partly the public policy aspect of it, and it puts more front and center the science aspect of it.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, this is an issue that like every country in the world is dealing with in one way or another. You know, how do you, you know, for really, really poor countries, it's just like, how do we get more energy access for our people? In developed countries, it's like, how do we not destroy our environment, feeding our incredible demand for energy? And then there's obviously climate change is this big overarching, you know, global problem that like is not really amenable to any kind of one country fixing it. And so I think one of the more promising things globally is the collaboration between scientists. We had an article in The Atlantic in December, you know, looking at the collaboration between Chinese and American scientists in you know, fixing coal or like, you know, reducing the impacts of coal on the globe.
The other part is that as the economic shift, as fossil fuel becomes more expensive and the cost of some of these other alternatives starts to go down, it is going to be incumbent upon companies that have been these big multinationals in the fossil fuel industry to become, as we're seeing, bigger and bigger players in all of this.
Yeah, and a lot of them support. I mean, you know, it's interesting. The role of fossil fuel companies in alternative energy is a fascinating one because, you know, they actually were some of the earliest supporters of photovoltaics. All kinds of people have been involved in the fossil fuel industry and have come over into alternative energy. And I actually think that's a really good thing, right? Because let's say you're building a power plant. Would you want the person who's building it or running it to be ideologically committed to the idea of the environment, or would you want them to know how to run a power plant? In the end, like that's actually one of the reasons why I think green technology can reconfigure the environmental movement in good ways, because it means creating a bigger tent, a more sort of pragmatic approach to problem solving, because you need to make the stuff work. And in order to make the stuff work, you sometimes need to have people on your team who aren't necessarily going to be committed to Mother Earth in like a really specific way.
Where is the nexus, do you think, between green technology and information technology? Because one arguably is creating greater energy demands, but it also sets a framework for solving some of these problems.
Yeah, I think it's really, I think that information technology is going to play a huge role in the future of the energy system. Right now, you know, you'll hear people talk a lot about the smart grid, and there's obviously been problems with various rollouts of smart meters. And I think, you know, we need to sort of, you know, there's a kind of short-term game and a long-term game. And in the short term, there's going to be a lot of hiccups and things are going to be hard to figure out. But in the long term, I think being able to control, particularly for commercial and industrial facilities, being able to sort of manage their power consumption with, you know, computer algorithms is like a big possible win. Because, you know, the way the energy system works, right, there's these peaks of demand, mm-hmm. and those are the things that create a lot of trouble. They both create blackouts. They cause us to turn on our dirtiest fossil fuels, fossil fuel power plants, the oldest ones, the ones that are rarely used. And they're also really expensive because the power that the price of power at those times is very high. And so what if instead of turning on that plant, right, you can turn off like every fifth light in a commercial building where like no one's really going to notice it anyway? Or you can draw on, you know, an industrial facility that operates, you know, 20 hours a day. You make sure that, you know, the 4 hours a day they're not operating are during this time when demand is going to be really high. And I think for people to deal with that problem, you know, particularly given that there are, you know, going to be thousands, millions of loads on the system, people are never going to be able to figure out what things to switch on and off. Mm-hmm. But the algorithms, like the sort of things that Google does, finding the important nodes in a network, that's like something that we're just getting so good at, and that will only get better, and that will play a major part of making our energy system more efficient.
Is that going to be part and parcel of what gets built in as the developing world comes more and more online in terms of its energy demands?
I think so. I mean, I think the developing world, you know, I don't think any of them have any illusions that, you know, they're going to be able to build an oil-fueled economy in the way that we did. You know, from 1900 again to about 1965, the U.S. Was a huge oil producer. And I don't think any developing country like feels like they are going to follow a similar path, even if they wanted to. it's just not possible. And so if you look at, you know, what people in China are doing in terms of the transport system specifically, right, they're kind of future-proofing their country. You know, they're building a lot of high-speed rail. They're building all these things that are incredibly energy-efficient ways of transporting people long distances. You know, something that in the U.S. we've never been forced to do, and so we haven't done.
Right, and they don't have the problem, because they're building it now, of an aging, energy-inefficient infrastructure.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the scarier things in America, that our energy infrastructure is so old, our plants are so old, which means that, you know, if you want to just even maintain the level of energy the consumption that we currently do, you'd have to, like, build a whole bunch of new plants, because a lot of our plants were built in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, all of which are getting old now. So, you know, I think it's when we think about the cost of these things, we have to remember that there are going to be costs anyway, just because we're going to have to rebuild parts of our energy infrastructure. And so when those times come around, I think we want to put in the cleanest solution possible to kind of future-proof ourselves.
Alexis Madrigal, his book is Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. It's just out from DiCapo Press. Alexis, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's my pleasure.